Good morning. This is Molly reading from Talking Information in Marshfield, Massachusetts. It is February 18th, and this morning I will be reading articles from National Geographic. And starting off, our first article is The Quest to Re-Engineer Beer. Scientists in Belgium that celebrated bastion of ancient beer culture are harnessing genetic breakthroughs and machine learning to reimagine how great booze gets built. Here's how their revelations in the lab could transform the global beer industry. The secretive beer lab inside the headquarters of the world's biggest brewing company doesn't often allow visitors, but today AB InBev has something it would like to show off. So David DeShutter, the head of AB InBev's Global Innovation and Technology Center, the official name of the beer lab, is showing me around the squat black building on the outskirts of Leuven, Belgium, about a half hour east of Brussels. Belgium is one of beer's ancestral homelands. Across the street from the lab is the brewery that makes Stella Artois. Leuven is crisscrossed by canals originally built by brewers to move their product. This is a beer company in a beer town and a beer country. So the office building has a dedicated tasting room with a kegerator. When we get there, DeShutter's colleagues have arrayed some snacks along with 12 different kinds of beer for me to try. That's enough beer to give Homer Simpson pause. Taste testing alcohol typically demands small sips, copious notes, and a lot of hepatic fortitude. But not today, because most of these beers are alcohol-free. This might come as a surprise. After all, in addition to Stella, AB InBev owns Budweiser, Corona, Modelo, Michelob, and several other well-known brands. It is to beer what Google is to the internet or ExxonMobil is to oil. And beer is generally understood to be alcoholic. Yet here I am, taking a skeptical sip of Michelob Ultra Zero and Corona Cero, AB InBev's state-of-the-art flagship non-alcoholic beers. As a technical matter, it's not hard to get the alcohol out of beer, but it's hard to make the result taste good. You tend to get something that is, to paraphrase the author Douglas Adams, almost but not quite entirely unlike beer. AB InBev introduced Michelob Ultra Zero in in early 2025, as the worldwide market for non-alcoholic beers was quickly ramping up, and these were the best tasting examples its science could deliver. They were fine. DeShutter is proud of these beers, but he must know they're merely fine. Then he offers me a bottle of the new state-of-the-art. This is AB InBev's latest biotechnological innovation, non-alcoholic Negra Modella, made with something dubbed smart yeast, a new strain of the essential microorganism that makes all beer possible. Modello is typically bottled at 5.4% alcohol. Smart yeast Modello, as I came to call it, clocks in at 0.4%. At the moment, Smart Yeast Modelo is available only in Mexico. It's basically still in beta. Modelo is my usual order with Mexican food, so I'm familiar enough to detect deviation from spec. In beer terms, Negra Modelo is a Munich-type Dunkel, mahogany-colored and malty. I take a whiff. It has the same roasted, hoppy aroma of Modelo. Now a sip. It has a good balance of sweeter malt and bitterness. The mouthful seems a little thin, maybe, slightly too astringent. It wasn't quite Modelo, but it was eminently drinkable. DeShutter takes a sip too, then looks at me. "We're super excited about this," he says. In 2024, AB InBev made $60 billion and produce 15 billion gallons of beer. But today, for the first time, after thousands of years of uninterrupted success, the nearly trillion-dollar beer industry is in decline. In beer-drinking epicenters like Belgium and Australia, consumption has gone down by 50% in the past half century. Beer consumption in the United States is down 25% since 1980. In 2023, Americans bought less beer than in any other year this century. Younger people in particular are drinking less, and no one's quite sure why. It's happening in places where marijuana is legal and where it's illegal, so that's not the culprit. They're certainly more health conscious and more skeptical of even moderate amounts of alcohol. A recent report from Rabobank hinted that Gen Zers spend less on booze because they have less money overall. But then, why are canned cocktails surging? Do Gen Zers really prefer a tall can of salted caramel banana piñata colada? What's abundantly clear is that beer is taking the hit category-wide, from ultra-bitter West Coast IPAs to English pub-style ales, with just one glaring exception, non-alcoholic beer. Sales of NA beers, defined as under 0.5% alcohol by volume, were up 29% in 2024 in the U.S. The marketing team at AB InBev saw this coming. For years, it has seen strong sales of so-called light beers, lower in calories and with less alcohol than a standard brew. And from a business perspective, non-alcoholic beer is all upside. It's a premium, high-priced product, says Dave Infante, author of the booze industry newsletter Fingers. And in the U.S., the companies don't pay excise tax on beer with no alcohol, so the margins are really attractive. NA beer could be the win that the industry sorely needs now. So AB InBev's scientists went back to the lab, hunting for a new way to make beer without alcohol that tasted as good as beer with it. They found a lot more, something that might explain not just how to make a new beer, but why people like it in the first place. If the science of beer enjoying has a unified field theory, this was the God particle. The key was the yeast. Yeast ferments, which is to say, it eats sugar and poops out carbon dioxide and alcohol. That is its whole ontological deal. But what if you could engineer a yeast that doesn't make alcohol at all? It would be a biochemical oxymoron, like a tree that grows bacon, in theory. In theory, such a yeast could be a building block for N.A. Negra Modelo and every other lab on InBev's shelf. To create this mycological unicorn, the company turned to one of the world's foremost scientists of beer, a yeast whisperer of sorts named Kevin Verstappen, whose lab happens to be on the other side of town from AB InBev headquarters. Led by its mad beer scientist, the company embarked on a quest almost Frankensteinian in its ambition and implications, with the potential to unlock not just non-alcoholic beer, but also NA wine, gin, whiskey. The God particle of beer holds the potential to be infinite in its beneficence. Get some grain, usually barley. Malt it, that is. Let the seeds germinate so they start making enzymes that convert their starch into sugar. Grind that up and put it in boiling water. Wait. Add yeast. Wait. Congratulations. You have made beer. Brewers are lovely nerds who delight in making things complicated. But basically, that's it. Yet for all that simplicity, beer is also deceptively complex. Amid a zillion variation of method and recipe, any given beer comprises not only the fizz of carbon dioxide and the sting of alcohol, but also flavors drawn from the grain, from the bitter flowers of a plant called hops, and from the biochemical transformations of yeast. yeast, specifically Saccharomyces cerevisiae, is found just about anywhere on Earth. It's the key to the foods that civilized human mankind. Bread for one, beer for another. The first beer-like drinks date back some 8,000 years, though brewers didn't know what yeast was until the mid-1800s. Early brewers simply relied on the alchemy of fermentation to turn little more than breakfast porridge into a flavorful beverage that also made people feel good and sold for good money. If yeast didn't exist, we'd have to invent it. By 2012, AB InBev had determined that the combination of flagging beer consumption and flavorless NA beer represented both a business and biotechnological opportunity. There was just one problem. Non-alcoholic beers have historically been, in a word, bad. Brewers made near beers by shortening fermentation time. The yeast made less alcohol, and the results tasted like watered-down Wheaties. No alcohol beer was quite stagnant, says DeShooter. Nobody had really put efforts into R&D. As DeShooter's team started digging in, the tech improved. Membranes and reverse osmosis, like water purification, could filter out alcohol. Heating beer with steam would cause the alcohol to evaporate. This new generation of NA beer was better, but still had some problems. Beer contains proteins, and heating them produced dimethyl sulfide, the aroma of boiled vegetables, components that are not necessarily part of the fresh beer aroma, DeShooter says with a diplomat's touch. So we set ourselves the goal, the dream, to make no alcohol beer as good as regular beer. That's a tall order. AB InBev is going to put NA beer into a bottle that says, Budweiser? Really? DeShooters insists this isn't about replacing Bud for a beer-agnostic generation. It's about building something new. The way we measure that is with consumer tests, he says. As good as is just probing for preference in the consumer panel. If, statistically, your beer is as good as the regular beer, you achieve your goal. Craft brewers would, let's just say, beg to differ. They're nerds. They make what they want to drink, whether that means a classic British stout or aged sour beer, fermented with ambient funky yeast, bittered with hops that taste like bong water, and finished with a dash of sriracha. They are making, and I say this in all sincerity, drinkable art. AB InBev is playing a very different game. Its NA beers can't be merely good. They have to be widely appealing. Chemically stable even amid the vagaries of international shipping. Consistent year after year. When it comes to non-alcoholic beer, that's really hard to do. Sure, 95% of beer is not alcohol, but that last 5% has always been the obstacle between a premium, scalable NA beer and wet breakfast cereal. Most of what we call flavor is actually smell. The tongue is a blunt detector of salt, sour, bitter, sweet, and the meaty flavor of umami. But the nose senses a far more subtle spectrum. Alcohol lights up all that, plus more. It is an aroma molecule, a flavor, and a smell. It also triggers heat receptors in the mouth, and it has an unctuous mouthfeel, what a connoisseur might call body. So its absence leaves a big hole. Adding grains like oats and rice can amp up mouthfeel, but from the beginning of their foray a decade ago, the AB InBev researchers have been determined to stick with their beer's original ingredients. As a first step in spackling over the gaps, they tweaked their brewing process to preserve long-chain carbohydrates called dextrins. They're nearly tasteless, but they add viscosity. To get alcohol out, DeShooter's team experimented with a variety of emerging techniques, all of which required expensive new equipment and lots of energy and water, just to produce results that always lacked a certain je ne sais quoi. Except scientists do know quoi. Dissolved within the alcohol are hundreds of other beery flavor molecules, from the banana smell of isomalt acetate to the clovish spiciness of 4-vinyl guaiacol. These volatile aromatic molecules give beer its flavor, and many are secondary metabolites that yeast produces during fermentation. Remove the alcohol and you remove them too. Only one solution was available. Add them back in afterward. Brewers working on NA beers squirted natural and artificial flavors into the products to cover a lack of flavor or mask their faults. More intense styles could pull this off with more panache. The toasty coffee aromas of a stout like Guinness, or the tropical fruit hoppiness of modern India pale ales. We can add other components that make it have more mouthfeel. We can add alcohol-adjacent chemicals, says Scott LaFontaine, a food chemist at the University of Arkansas who studies beer. That's where understanding fermentation and yeast biochemistry are essential to creating a beer-like adjacent product. LaFontaine's research suggests that the more a beer tastes like soda pop, the more Americans will like it. Not this American, for the record. And sure, the best beer-adjacent products can be quite good, but in my experience, they lose something as they sit in a glass. They taste good at the top, fine in the middle, and then, well, I rarely finish them. Without the alcohol matrix, those flavors fizz away more quickly. DeShooter's team decided on a different approach. Yeasts eat sugar and excrete alcohol and all those other flavors, secondary metabolites. But what if a yeast made only those other flavors? AB InBev needed a bacon tree. Luckily, the world has a lot of yeasts. The lager-style beers, for instance, light, clear, and popular, like Budweiser, aren't made with yeast, but with a different species, the hybrid Pastorianus. This is why breweries are so careful with their special yeast strains. When strains reproduce, they mutate. So brewers keep their yeast frozen and only scrape out tiny samples at a time. The original batch must never break containment. For me, the yeast is the soul of the beer, DeShooter says. If you want to make a Stella Artois, you need to have the Stella Artois yeast. The same goes for any of the other beers in the AB InBev line. With human nudging, yeasts have evolved into a wolfish apex predators that feast on the range of sugars we extract from grains, from smaller, simpler ones like glucose and fructose, to bigger, more complex ones like maltose and maltotriose. Brewing yeasts eat them all, but more demure species and strains exist too. These Pomeranians of the yeast world can't handle the big sugars. They still ferment, and they create interesting aromatic molecules, but they produce far less alcohol. DeShooter's team tried one of these alt yeast back in 2017, a yeast from the genus Peachia. During my visit, DeShooter offered me a small plastic cup filled with the result, a sweet, beer-like liquid with strong notes of apple, now and later candy. It was the wrong yeast. The NA yeast of the future would be just as important to AB InBev as the one that makes Stella. But DeShooter and his team didn't have the background to find it. He needed some help, someone with a uniquely tailored biochemical expertise. He needed a yeast whisperer. Kevin Verstrappen is the director of a lab with a name that's going to make you wish you chose a different major in college. the KU Leuven Institute for Beer Research. He didn't set out to pioneer beer flavor. Pursuing a biological engineering degree with notions of delivering the next world-changing vaccine, he eventually made his way to the South Africa lab of Isaac Pretorius, a geneticist studying yeast, specifically winemaking yeast. Long story short, I loved it, Verstreppen says, a student in a wine lab, learning how to taste wine. That experience also gave Verstreppen his first sense of beer making as a biotechnology. So out went my plans to come up with a cancer vaccine. He went back to KU Leuven and got a PhD in applied biological sciences with a minor in beer. After stints at MIT and Harvard, where Verstreppen co-created a wildly popular freshman seminar that used beer and brewing to teach basic biochemistry and bioengineering, Leuven offered him a job of studying how yeasts work, from brewing beer to manufacturing pharmaceuticals. No one is doing more to link beer's sociocultural history with its high-tech, non-alcoholic future. Much of the equipment in Verstreppen's lab is designed to help understand yeast's chemical outputs. Refrigerator-sized analytic engines can discern aromas and flavors with molecular precision. A 7-foot-tall translucent cabinet contains a miniaturized assembly line, bristling with robot arms, dabbing at tiny dishes, each executing thousands of tiny chemical reactions all at once. Verstreppen, tall and lean like a cyclist and wearing avant-garde eyeglass frames, is an expert at cracking yeasts open to see what they can do. DeShooter's team tasked him with finding a yeast with a very specific set of skills, and back at his lab, he had a freezer full of 1,000 different kinds of yeasts, a genetic library of untapped potential abilities. The lab's high throughput screening technologies could flip through them like an old Rolodex looking for the right skill sets. You don't have to know the underlying genetic mechanisms, Verstreppen says. You just have to find good parents. Anyone who follows horse racing or the Westminster Kennel Club understands breeding. But in horses and dogs, or even barley, generating traits you want and sifting out those you don't can take years, not yeasts. They pick up new genes as casually as we might change shirts. And they breed fast. Consider how quickly a sourdough starter overflows its jar. Combine strains with interesting traits, grow them, test them. If you want one that's resistant to high temperatures, just put them all in a hot bath. One survives. Guess what? That's your champion, Verstreppen says. With flavor, you do a small fermentation and measure the flavor components, or do a tasting, which is more precise. So that's what we do. Verstreppen's team started out with more than 1,000 candidates. Weeding out the ones that still made too much alcohol got the list down to about 20. Like a lot of wild yeasts, most of the survivors also produce phenols, molecules that, depending on your childhood, remind you either of dirt or Band-Aids. Phenolic character is typically something we accept in a specialty beer, but not in a lager. DeShooter says, they cut those two. That left them with just two candidates. Unfortunately, one manifested a tendency to kill any other yeast it came into contact with, thanks to its acquisition of a viral gene for a vicious toxin. That wouldn't matter unless the new yeast got into a legacy batch. But since they planned to make non-alcoholic beer in the same breweries as alcoholic ones, they'd have to eliminate the trait. They couldn't risk unleashing a serial killer. After a few final rounds of heat treating to stamp out the toxin gene, the champ emerged, an ancient Cerevisia collected from plants in Southeast Asia, yeast's evolutionary point of origin. It had a stable phenotype. It ate simple sugar, but didn't consume maltose, and so it made only the teensiest amount of alcohol. It wasn't phenolic. It didn't want to murder the other yeast. As a last hurdle, DeShooter's team took the yeast to AB InBev's brewery in Mexico, home to a massive fermenter capable of brewing over 300,000 gallons at a time. Flavor is fine, but it had to scale. When you make 15 billion gallons of beer a year, there's no room for a dilettante. This yeast delivered as advertised. The company nicknamed it Smart Yeast and started brewing. Belgian beer is very traditional, but the tradition is constant experimentation. This is the point Yvan Debates wants me to absorb as we sit in the pub attached to his brewery, Brasserie de la Seine, on an industrial stretch of the Brussels Canal near the trendy Gare Maritime. Designed by Debates and his business partner, it's a concrete-walled beer cathedral with giant windows showcasing all the steel tanks and pipes next door. We're sipping a beer called Petite Bulba, his version of a low-alcohol brew. At 2.5% alcohol by volume, it's bright, hoppy, and cheerful. I did that selfishly to save my liver, Debat says. I never worked so hard on a recipe in my life. As Debates tells it, Belgian beer has always refracted styles from around the continent. In 1516, Bavaria enacted what was effectively an early national food safety law, the Reichenstadt, or Purity Order, mandating that beer, a critically important regional foodstuff, be made only with water, barley, and hops. Belgium combined this Bavarian rigidity with English facility into lower alcohol, sessionable brews, and southern styles full of wine-like esters. The oldest Belgian beers, like the lambics, relied on spontaneous fermentations, using ambient yeasts with funkier, weirder flavors. When trade introduced ingredients like anise, coriander, or the peel of the bitter Curacao orange, Belgians threw them into the mix. It makes sense, in other words, that Belgians would be working on the non-alcoholic future of beer. Brewing innovation is inextricable from the culture. It's the home of Meccas like the St. Sixtus Abbey, whose Westvelderen 12 is by some lights the best beer period. And the city of Bruges, a brewery founded in 1565, constructed a 2-mile underground beer pipeline from its brewery to its bottling plant so that its trucks wouldn't disturb the medieval downtown. You have to respect a country where every individual brew has its own specially shaped glass. Alcohol tax policy, fashion, and new science can all redirect the development of emerging styles, a sociology of taste, as Debates elegantly puts it. But he worries that non-alcoholic brews will always be missing a certain something. The techniques are way, way, way better than even 15 years ago, he admits. Still, I believe the base product is not so appealing. And yet, the runaway success of the non-alcoholic craft brewer Athletic suggests that may just be the connoisseurship talking. Not only is Athletic the biggest NA brewer in the U.S., it's the country's 18th largest brewer overall, with 2024 sales of $130 million and a valuation of $800 million. One big reason is that people actually like to drink it. Athletic is notably closed-mouthed about how it makes beer, unusual in an industry known for cooperation and openness, and it's still a munchkin compared to AB InBev. But it's persuasive proof of market, and as an added economic inducement, it's legal for brewers to advertise NA brands alongside popular sports like Formula One racing. They can appeal to the mainstream in ways that even the king of beers can't. Smart yeast may solve a specific corporate problem, but the idea, the concept of new yeasts for new beers might transform the way we think about flavor writ large. Even with all the high-tech analytic and sensory equipment and Verstappen's lab, assessing something as complex as beer requires the nose and tongue of a trained expert, someone capable of describing its characteristic aromas with poetic precision, using a shared, quantifiable vocabulary where this term means that smell. Toasted caramel, grapefruit rind, sourdough bread, to define the various distinct sensations in a single sip of beer. That's not me. I'm just a writer who has consumed a lot of beer. Nevertheless, Verstappen has invited me to sit in on an evaluation of a couple of the candidate yeasts he's working on. It's time to drink beer for science. His team tucks me into a private study carrel, like one you'd find in a library. I am served amber glasses of beer with numbers affixed to them and a sheaf of worksheets that gives me SAT flashbacks. It's harder than it sounds. Both beers taste like, well, beer. But the worksheets want to know much more. I'm supposed to rate their maltiness on a scale of 1 to 9. But also, is it malty like cereal? Or like bread crust? Or caramel? Is it hoppy like grapefruit or like pine resin? Any smell of banana? Do I detect sulfur? Actually, one was more sulfury. I check boxes frantically. My reporting notes say only I'm too slow. These are the subtle differences between a mind-blowing, transnational, non-alcoholic beer of the future and one you'd pour down the drain. In 2024, Verstappen's team chemically analyzed 250 Belgian beers and crunched data from 180,000 online reviews, which they then combined with judgments from the lab's trained panel, the ones I sat in with, and used machine learning algorithms to detect commonalities. The Belgian beers that people prefer are all likely to have higher levels of protein, lactic acid, the sour and sour beers like lambics, and the molecules ethyl acetate, a kind of solventy chemical smell, and floral honeyed ethyl phenylacetate. Add a concoction of those notes to a non-alcoholic beer, and people will just say they like it just as much as a regular one. Verstappen says he hopes the mixture of aromas his machine learning work has produced will go beyond creating post-structuralist beer-like sensations. He wants to rescue non-alcoholic wine, too. And after that, I tasted a formula he's working on for non-alcoholic gin. It was close, down to the warming sensation. The model gave us components that I wouldn't have thought about, he says. Sure, I say, but the warming thing, it's the pain and heat centers and the trigeminal nerve. I venture a guess that he did it with capsaicin, which is what makes chili peppers hot. Verstappen hesitates. There are millions of dollars at stake here. He says only that it's not chili pepper, and then he clams up. He's not the world's only yeast whisperer after all. Big commodity yeast companies, yes, that's a thing, sell maltose negative strains similar to smart yeast. A California startup offers a genetically engineered versions that could add even more bespoke flavors to a beer or wine while cutting out the alcohol. The non-alcoholic beers that emerge will be something wholly new, maybe even something delicious and wildly popular. But then, is it really still beer? That's something debates hinted at over drinks at Brasserie de la Seine. I really believe that alcohol belongs to beer, he said. There is no beer without alcohol. Obviously, debates acknowledged, alcohol can be addictive and has all kinds of potential societal costs. But for millennia, Humans have enjoyed having conversations with each other while their minds are slightly altered. A little less suspicious, a little more relaxed. And we need them now as much as ever. You see what we're living in today, he said. The world is a catastrophe. We need to rebuild those high-quality connections. Of course, the people eagerly downing NA beers in bars and at parties probably feel the quality of their connection is just fine. And people who don't drink alcohol for health or religious reasons deserve a beer-like product that actually tastes good. The market wants what it wants. I left Belgium with a souvenir, a bottle of Smart Yeast Negra Modelo from the table in that AB InBev tasting room. I carried it home in my luggage, wrapped in T-shirts. On a warm afternoon, a couple of weeks later, I cracked it open, and it was still good. I still liked it. I wasn't trying to fix our dystopia. I was just having a cold beer. Continuing, the next article I'm going to read is titled Why It's So Hard to Fuel the Artemis Rockets, written by Swapna Krishna. This week, NASA called off its February launch attempts for Artemis II, its first crewed mission to the moon since 1972, after issues arose during a fueling and countdown dress rehearsal. Now, pending fixes, the earliest Artemis II can launch is March 6, 2026. The issues flagged during dress rehearsal included communication dropouts between ground teams, cameras impacted by cold weather, a pressurization valve for the crew capsule hatch, and notably liquid hydrogen fuel leaks while loading propellant into or tanking the rocket. All in all, a very successful day for us on many fronts, said launch director Charlie Blackwell Thompson at a press conference. Then on a couple of others, we've got some work we've got to do to go, and we're going to do it. We'll figure it out. If those hydrogen leaks sound familiar, it's because Artemis 1 had the exact same issue. Almost 4 years ago, in April 2022, NASA called off the third launch rehearsal for Artemis 1 because of liquid hydrogen fuel leaks. The agency ended up rolling the Space Launch System, i.e. the SLS, rocket back to its assembly building to make repairs, and Artemis 1 didn't launch until months later in November 2022. Even then, during the actual Artemis 1 launch countdown, a crew was sent to the launch pad to tighten a bolt because of a leaky valve. With more than 3 years between SLS launches, we fully anticipated encountering challenges, NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman wrote on X. That is precisely why we conduct a wet dress rehearsal. These tests are designed to surface issues before flight and set up launch day with the highest probability of success. But why is NASA encountering the exact same issues with the rocket that it did 4 years ago? Issues it has already troubleshooted for many years. To understand that, it's helpful to learn the history of SLS and the finicky nature of liquid hydrogen. Liquid hydrogen fuel is hard to work with. SLS uses two types of propellant, liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. Liquid oxygen is relatively easy to work with. Liquid hydrogen, however, is not. It's particularly prone to leaking because it's such a small molecule, capable of escaping through the tiniest equipment gaps. It also must be kept at extremely cold temperatures, minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit, to stay in liquid form. In turn, that extreme cold can then affect the integrity of the seals, leading to the increased leak rates. Many modern rocket companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin are moving away from liquid hydrogen for these reasons, pivoting their fuel to a blend of liquid methane and liquid oxygen, which isn't as leak-prone and can be stored at higher temperatures, minus 295 degrees Fahrenheit. However, liquid hydrogen also has its benefits. It's environmentally friendly. The byproduct of liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen in water and is very efficient. But for NASA, there wasn't much of a choice to use alternative fuel sources for SLS. When Congress authorized the Space Launch System back in 2010, they mandated that the rocket be used on Heritage Space Shuttle technology. That means that the RS-25 engines that power SLS are simply upgraded and refurbished engines from the space shuttle, which required liquid hydrogen fuel. Three of Artemis II's four engines are previously flown space shuttle engines. One is new. The space shuttle also has problems with leaks during its operation. The final flight of the space shuttle Discovery was delayed due to hydrogen leaks. This decision was initially made to save money on SLS, but it hasn't worked out in practice. In 2023, the NASA Office of the Inspector General estimated the cost of SLS has ballooned to around $4.2 billion per launch. NASA's retired space shuttle program, which also grew more expensive than its designers intended, cost around $1.5 billion per launch. The good news, NASA did manage to fully fuel SLS. For most of the dress rehearsal, the fueling test actually went quite smoothly. When a leak was detected soon after propellant loading began, the team was able to deploy a technique refined during Artemis 1 and warm up a key seal before continuing. But then another issue arose. Because of the super cold hydrogen fuel heats up after loading and actually boils off, it must continually be replenished. An increase in leak rates during this replenishment then led to the rehearsal being called off at T5 minutes. Now, teams must identify exactly which seal is leaking and make repairs to it while the rocket is out on the launch pad, which is not an easy task. We have to go inspect the seal and see what condition it's in, said Amit Krishna, NASA Associate Administrator, at a press conference this week. NASA is implementing procedures developed during Artemis 1 to conduct this work without rolling the rocket back to its assembly building in hopes of making those March launch dates. Then, after adjustments are made, the agency will have to attempt and complete a second rehearsal before clearing SLS to fly. The bottom line is that despite being built on a legacy technology, SLS has only flown once before, and NASA is still learning as they go. Continuing, the next article is called A Walk After Eating Can Change How the Brain and Body Respond to Food, written by Tiffany Nieslanek. Eating doesn't just refuel the body. It sets off a carefully timed sequence of physiological changes, particularly in the minutes that follow a meal. During this window, research suggests post-meal movement could do more than settle your stomach. It might reshape how your body processes food and how your brain responds to it. So what is happening during this post-meal window, and how could a short walk help shape the process? What your body and brain do after a meal. Digestion is an active, whole-body event. Shortly after we eat, our bodies shift into rest and digest mode, a period when the gut and brain communicate intensively, exchanging signals that influence digestion, mood, and stress levels. Carbohydrates, fats, and proteins are broken down into glucose, fatty acids, and amino acids, which are then released into your bloodstream. This creates a sensitive window for the gut-brain axis, the bi-directional highway of nerves and signals linking digestion with stress and mood. It's also the perfect time to move, says Loretta DiPietro, an exercise and nutrition scientist at the George Washington University. What post-meal exercise does for your body and brain. When you move, even with a leisurely stroll, your muscles contract, which helps draw sugar out of your bloodstream and into cells. This process happens independently of insulin, which is especially helpful for older adults, people with insulin resistance, or anyone eating a big evening meal when insulin tends to work less efficiently. That means movement gives your body a second pathway for managing blood sugar. It can help blunt sharp post-meal spikes and reduce the workload on your pancreas. Over time, that relief can help protect metabolic health and reduce risk factors for diabetes and heart disease. Exercise bypasses the defects in insulin signaling, says Gerald Shulman, professor of medicine at Yale. It opens the door for glucose to enter the cell, even in people with insulin resistance. But these metabolic benefits tell only part of the story. Movement during this post-meal recovery state also increases blood flow to digestive organs and supports interception, the brain's sense of what's happening inside the body. Recent studies suggest that the vagus nerve, a key communication line between the gut and brain, helps shape how we feel after eating. One study found it plays a role in everything, from sensing fullness to managing emotions. Another found that gut bacteria can influence this nerve, linking what we eat to how our bodies and minds respond. Scientists are still mapping these connections, but the evidence suggests post-meal walks support brain-body communication in ways that extend well beyond digestion. When and how to move after a meal. The timing doesn't have to be exact. DiPietro says that moving about 30 minutes after you put your fork down may be the ideal time, but notes that benefits begin as soon as people start moving. Shulman agrees, adding that movement at any time of day can improve insulin sensitivity. The activity doesn't have to be intense or prolonged. DiPietro's research suggests that 15 minutes of light walking blunts post-meal glucose spikes. A 2025 study, back this up, finding that a 10-minute walk immediately after a meal improved blood sugar control just as well as a 30-minute walk done later. You don't even need to break a sweat, Shulman says. The key is simply to move. The activity itself doesn't need to be intense or prolonged. Another 2025 study showed that interrupting long sitting periods with 2 to 5 minute bouts of light walking, even pacing indoors or climbing stairs, can help significantly reduce post-meal glucose and insulin spikes in adults with obesity. And these benefits extend beyond those with insulin resistance. Shulman notes that even in lean young adults, post-meal movement improves how muscles store energy, potentially supporting metabolic health across the lifespan. The key to the benefits lies in consistency. To see lasting effects, post-meal movement needs to be repeated daily. From an evolutionary perspective, says DiPietro, humans were wired to move after eating, a rhythm that supported using energy rather than storing it. Walking after meals may be one simple way to reintroduce that expectation into modern life. A small habit with whole body impact. A post-meal stroll won't replace medication or radically reshape your metabolism overnight, but it's a small shift with outsized potential, part of a bigger picture about how movement, food, and health are deeply interconnected. If an evening walk feels out of reach, start smaller. Put on music and do the dishes vigorously. Walk the dog a little farther. March in place. As DiPietro says, just move. This article is titled Inside Taiwan's Butterfly Kingdom. A rare natural wonder takes place every year. written by Ashish Valentine. Hidden in a mountain valley in southern Taiwan lies one of the world's greatest natural wonders. Every winter, tens of thousands of butterflies blanket the branches and forest understory of Mayalin. If you're lucky enough to see them take flight, you'll witness their wings, usually a somber brown with small pink specks, flash blue and violet as the forest itself flickers like a living mosaic of iridescent colors. The Seven Valleys of Mayalin are Taiwan's best-known winter refuge for purple crow butterflies, a collection of four similar-looking species known in English as the blue-banded king crow, the double-banded crow, the striped blue crow, and the dwarf crow. Each October, hundreds of thousands of them embark on a months-long journey south to gather in secluded valleys like those in Mayalin. Come spring, they'll leave to lay their eggs all over the island, ready to begin the cycle of life anew. It's a similar phenomena to the monarch butterfly migration in North America, which sees millions of butterflies migrate along the coasts of the United States to spend the winter in natural sanctuaries in central Mexico. Although the North American monarchs are one of the world's best-known migratory species, the purple crow migration is fiercely beloved by nature lovers in Taiwan. The attention that the migration has received in recent years has even inspired some ordinary people to do what they can to ensure future generations can marvel at the migration in all its glory. And unlike the monarchs, the multi-species purple crow migration is globally rare. Particularly one as short as the 300 miles they journey across Taiwan. Scientists are still trying to better understand why these four species behave this way, and the clock is ticking. Like the monarchs, this butterfly migration is imperiled. Saving this wondrous phenomena starts with understanding it. Taiwan's immense biodiversity has earned it the nickname the Butterfly Kingdom. It's home to over 400 butterfly species, 55 of which are found nowhere else in the world. In that kingdom, there are plenty of butterfly obsessives. Yet, in the purple crow realm, one man reigns supreme. Chan Qianlong is an insect scientist and filmmaker who has dedicated his life to studying the purple crow butterflies and whose tireless work over the last 25 years is what made their winter is what made their winter migration such a cultishly beloved phenomena. And he's still at it. Just 2 years ago, his feature-length documentary, Lost Butterfly, introduced a generation of Taiwanese viewers to their beauty. The first time Chan himself learned about the purple crow butterflies was in elementary school, he says, when his aunt gave him a photo book about them. But it wasn't until Chan visited the Mayalin Butterfly Valleys as a college student in the early 1990s that he was humbled by the sight of thousands of them. As the butterfly flaps its wings, the angle that the sunlight reflects off them and hits your eye changes. Out of 17 different colors, there's only one angle where your eye can see the iridescent purple color, Chan says. The effect is so pronounced that tree branches, at first glance seemingly covered in dead leaves, reveal themselves to be swarming with hundreds of butterflies, only noticeable when their wings catch the sunlight. When Chan first visited, the butterfly valleys of Mayalin were known mainly to insect experts, ecologists, and people in the area. Mayalin is the island's least populated district, at least when it comes to people. Only about 1,800 people live there, mostly from the indigenous Rukai community, which has called these valleys home for countless centuries. Today, however, nearly 100,000 people descend upon Mayalin between November and March of each year to take in the incredible sight. That shift is largely thanks to Chan's work, a mission he took up in 1999 after discovering his most beloved butterfly viewing spot in the region had been turned into a parking lot. In just one moment, I realized even the most common species could be endangered, Chan said. A changing habitat. On a weekend morning in a forest a short drive from the bustling downtown of the northern capital, Taipei, a group of mostly retired volunteers with the Taiwan Butterfly Conservation Society gathers at a local hiking trail. Everyone brings a snack to share. While munching on rice balls and steamed pork buns, they prepare long butterfly nets, clipboards, binoculars, and notebooks. Once everyone is ready, volunteers lead the group uphill. By late November, most purple crows have flown south, but a few linger in the north. When Sai Pops spots a purple crow butterfly, he starts swinging his net, working fast but gently. The goal is to trap the butterfly without harming its delicate wings. Scientists studying bird migrations often use GPS trackers to map a bird's flight path, but butterflies are too light for that. Instead, once he's caught a butterfly, Sai delicately scribbles a series of letters and numbers on its wing. After he releases the butterfly, the hope is that another volunteer will catch it again elsewhere in Taiwan and record its code again. The resulting data will help researchers understand its life cycle and migration path. The protectors of the butterflies. Like the scientists and volunteers studying the plight of butterflies in Taipei, the indigenous Rukai community have become the butterflies' most passionate stewards in Maolin. Tang Hsing Jin, an indigenous conservationist, says that this is because of their ancient set of values. It's no accident, he says. They have been working with local officials to evaluate local development plans and help limit butterfly habitat loss in places like Maolin. In areas where habitat had already been lost, Zhu and another members of the Butterfly Society have been helping town government find parks and green spaces where native plants can be reintroduced in a way that naturally supports caterpillars, butterflies, and a variety of other wildlife. And these efforts have real support in Taiwan, where local governments have historically been receptive to protecting the butterflies. Almost 20 years ago, the filmmaker Chan Ching-lung reported on how migrating butterflies were being killed by cars as they flew across national highways. In response, the Ministry of Transportation directed road crews to put up nets during peak migration periods, and some highways close lanes when enough butterflies are detected crossing the road. The Freeway Bureau also lined the entirety of Taiwan's National Highway 3, which runs parallel to a prominent butterfly migration path, with native trees and shrub species. Well, folks, I hope that you enjoyed listening to me read these fascinating articles this morning. It is time for me to sign off. Have a wonderful day.